CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
It's finally fall. The weather is cooling off, and there's no better time to upgrade your cookouts than right now. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. They have a huge menu of steaks and more. The process is convenient and quick, shopping delivered straight to your door. Every purchase is backed by Omaha Steaks' 100% unconditional guarantee. And right now, you can get the limited-time family grill pack for just $49.99. You get all of this. 2 5-ounce filet mignons, 2 5-ounce top sirloins, 4 4-ounce boneless pork chops, 4 3.5-ounce chicken fried steaks, 12-ounce package of all-beef meatballs, 4 4-ounce Omaha Steak Burgers, 4 4-ounce Gourmet Jumbo Franks, a 16-ounce package of Omaha Steakhouse Fries, 4 caramel apple tartlets, OS seasoning packet, plus 4 additional Omaha Steaks Burgers. Just for listening, Omaha Steaks is offering all of this for only $49.99. This is a huge savings. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter code FTN in the search bar, and add the Family Grill Pack to your cart. Don't miss this deal. Visit omahasteaks.com and enter code FTN in the search bar to get over 30 gourmet items for just $49.99.
Today on Face the Nation, Death of a Dictator, and we give thanks to some Americans who help others. Cuban Americans celebrated in the streets of Miami after communist leader Fidel Castro died Friday at the age of 90. Castro's 5 decades of repressive rule spanned 10 U.S. presidents. What impact will his death have? We'll talk to Florida Senator Marco Rubio and get a report from Havana. Then we'll devote time to people we're grateful for on this holiday weekend. And our reporters panel will weigh in on how the Trump transition is going. It's all ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. For the last 60 years, dictator Fidel Castro was America's most persistent adversary. Although Castro formally handed off to his brother Raul 8 years ago, the communist leader was a symbolic force in Cuba and around the world. We begin this morning with CBS News correspondent Manuel Bajorquez, who joins us from Havana. Manuel, what's the reaction to Castro's death?
John, good morning. The usually busy and bustling streets of Havana are decidedly quiet this morning. Yesterday afternoon at his alma mater, Havana University, students held a remembrance for their leader. Mourners here will have a first opportunity to publicly pay their respects starting tomorrow, with the largest gathering expected on Tuesday at Havana's Revolution Square.
Viva la Revolución!
The scene of some of Castro's most fiery speeches. His remains will then be taken down a symbolic route from Havana to Santiago, Cuba, essentially retracing in reverse the victory march he took with the Revolutionary Army in 1959. His funeral will be held next Sunday in Santiago, known as the cradle of Castro's revolution. John?
Manuel Bajorquez for us in Havana, Cuba. Thanks, Manuel. Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio is the son of Cuban immigrants, and he joins us from Miami. Senator, what would you like to see change in U.S.-Cuba relations now?
Well, I'd like to see more of a democratic opening on the island of Cuba. Things like, I don't know, free press, stop putting people in jail because they don't agree with you politically, stop helping countries like North Korea invade U.N. sanctions, don't invite the Russians to open a military base 90 miles from our shores. Allow independent political parties to be able to function. You know, the kinds of things that you find in virtually every country in the Western Hemisphere, except Cuba and now increasingly Venezuela. That's what I'd like to see, and I'd like to see our foreign policy geared towards accelerating that.
President-elect Trump has called Fidel Castro a brutal dictator, but then he did not renew his promise to reverse President Obama's executive order reopening relations. He didn't talk about an embargo. So was that a sufficient response by your lights?
Yeah, it's no different than the one I put out. Look, I think what we need to do is understand our number one obligation is to act in the national interest of the United States of America. I believe it is in our national interest to see democracy take hold on the island of Cuba. And so we should examine our foreign policy, including all the changes that President Obama made, through in that lens.
But examine and, why not just reverse?
Well, as I said, there are key elements that are more important than others. So we'll look at all of them. Here's the thing people don't understand. I've said this repeatedly. I am not against changes in U.S. policy towards Cuba. I just want to make sure that those changes are reciprocal, that they're reciprocated by the Cuban government. That was not part of what President Obama did. And I want to make sure that they are the kinds of things that help create a pathway towards democracy in Cuba. Because while Fidel Castro was 90 years old, his brother's 85. There is going to be a generational leadership change in Cuba over the next 5 to 10 years, hopefully sooner. And we need to ensure that our foreign policy towards Cuba incentivizes and makes it easier for there to be a democratic transition. That's how I would examine our foreign policy towards Cuba.
Why is this such an important issue for Americans who may not know about the history of American-Cuban relations in the Cold War?
Well, it's no longer about the Cold War. It's important for three reasons. Number one, Cuba continues to be a source of instability in the region. For example, historic numbers of people are fleeing the island of Cuba, putting migratory pressure on the United States. Number two, this Cuban government is anti-American. They allow the Chinese and the Russians to conduct espionage, electronic espionage and others from the island of Cuba. Number three, they harbor fugitives of American justice. There are people living on the island of Cuba who have violated American law, including those who have stolen millions of dollars from Medicare fraud in South Florida and have fled to Cuba. Those are three reasons right there to care about what's happening on the island of Cuba, which happens to be 90 miles from our shores, basically a neighboring country.
Let me step back and look at President-elect Trump. His position towards countries like Cuba, I want to get your sense of it, because he was asked about the U.S. force overseas, and he said, our country has a lot of problems. When the world looks at how bad the United States is, and then we go talk about civil liberties, I don't think we're a very good messenger. I don't know that we have a right to lecture. We're not in a position to be more aggressive. We have to fix our own mess. That seems like retreating from dealing with the kinds of problems you just outlined in Cuba. And let's speak more broadly about Syria, Russia, other countries with whom you have disagreements, and President-elect Trump doesn't seem to want to meddle.
Well, I don't know when he made that statement. I can say to you that, as I would with any other president, number one, he's been elected. I want to give him a chance to succeed. If I agree with him on a foreign policy matter, I look forward to working with his administration. If I do not agree with him on a foreign policy matter, be they a Republican or a Democrat, I'll disagree and try to offer an alternative and hopefully do what we can from the Senate to change and influence our foreign policy.
In your list of objections to Cuba, you mentioned meddling in American affairs. U.S. intelligence says that the Russians attempted to interfere in the United States election. What's your assessment of Russia efforts in the U.S. election?
If you recall, during the election, I was up for re-election, and I did not or would not talk about WikiLeaks during that period of time, because I do not, as I said, I believe it's the work of a foreign intelligence agency. I believe Americans need to know. I don't believe that they changed the outcome of the election. I want to be clear about that. But I do think that it is some of the things we saw are very reminiscent of the active measures that Russian intelligence and before that Soviet intelligence agencies used to try to undermine the government or individual politicians in foreign countries.
Should the U.S. retaliate if there's evidence the Russians were involved?
Well, again, I'm not going to speak to specifics of what the U.S. should do in response, because it's an intelligence matter. All I would say is that if, in fact, there is evidence that these were active measures on the part of the Russian government, the American people deserve to know. But I want to be clear, I do not believe that in any way what they did ultimately changed the outcome of the election. But the American people need to be made aware if, in fact, there is evidence that a foreign government tried to interfere with or influence the direction of our politics.
Donald Trump is looking at his Secretary of State picks. Without getting into the personalities, what attributes should he look for in a Secretary of State?
Well, first of all, someone who is capable of being the chief diplomat of the United States, hopefully someone who has a deep-rooted commitment in human rights and a strong national security on the part of our country, who has an understanding of the complexities of the world today, and someone who understands that the world is a better place when America plays a leading role in leading the free world in confronting the challenges of the 21st century. I think he has a bevy of people to pick from. Ultimately, he has to choose someone that he's comfortable with, because he won this election. He has a right to pick someone as his Secretary of State that he feels comfortable with. And I think there are a number of qualified candidates that could fit the bill.
Senator Marco Rubio, thanks so much for being with
us. Thank you.
For some analysis on the Cuba situation, we turn to Julia Swag, a senior research fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, and the author of Cuba, What Everyone Needs to Know. She is also a CBS News Cuba analyst and has been advising American companies doing business in Cuba. We're also joined by Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic and the last American journalist to interview Fidel Castro. So you both were with Fidel Castro. Jeffrey, I want to start with you. What was that like? This is in 2010,
right? It was very, very strange. You know, he was in retirement, but he still functioned as sort of the maximum leader, if you will. He called me down to Cuba to discuss an issue that was of concern to him, the Iranian nuclear program and the threat of nuclear war in the Middle East. And so having a conversation with one of the most incendiary figures of the Cuban Missile Crisis was one of the more interesting moments of my life. I had Julia with me on this trip. The key memory, or one of the key memories of this, is when I asked him if he regrets asking Khrushchev in 1962 to annihilate the United States with nuclear weapons. And he paused and he said, in essence, he said, yeah, that was probably a bit too much. It was continued that entire week to be a very, very strange week.
Yeah, Julia, did he mellow with old age?
Considerably. With Jeff, and then a couple of days later into that week, I spent a day with him talking about the history, the 1950s, and I found him to be conversational, which was not his style when he was in power. Subsequently, after 2010, as he became a bit weaker, he certainly did mellow, and he was pointedly, at least directly, stayed out of his brother's way as his brother Raul advanced a modest reform process.
He mellowed, but not to the degree that he seemed to be very happy with Barack Obama's opening to Cuba. Fidel Castro, for 50-plus years, needed the confrontation with the United States in order to... That was his reason for living, in a kind of way. And Obama subverted, in a very obvious sort of way, the Fidel Castro narrative. And Raul, who is in power, changed in a more pragmatic way.
Subverted by taking away the boogeyman of the
United
States.
Taking away the boogeyman, yeah.
Julia, let's historically look back at the full career of Fidel Castro. What should history think of him?
Well, it's a long and complex career. There is the analysis that will say, look, this guy took power, shut down speech, put people in prison, had a human rights legacy that was quite challenging and difficult for many people who were on the other end of it. On the other hand, he rewrote the social contract in Cuba, in a small island nation, in which he put healthcare, education, culture, and the capacity for Cuba to have an independent foreign policy front and center as part of his legacy. And in Cuba, and I think we have to understand that there are 11 million people in Cuba, that legacy will be digested as giving Cuba a place on the world stage.
But there are three things that many Cubans will say Castro did well: healthcare, education, culture. But the joke is that there are three things that Fidel Castro didn't do well for the Cuban people, which was breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so you're looking at a guy who impoverished, or kept his country in an impoverished state because he refused to open up to capitalist reforms. And obviously, on the political front, we will remember him in America as a guy who suppressed freedom. I mean, there's no way around the fact that it is a single party communist state and remains so.
What now does U.S. policy look like towards Cuba, Jeffrey?
Well, we're at a really pivotal moment. What the Obama administration is trying to do is lock in some of the changes before it's too late, before Donald Trump comes in. And he has threatened, obviously, to reverse some of these changes. So I think what the Obama administration right now is trying to do is make sure that these openings continue. Their best ally in this, of course, is American business. A lot of American businesses are very interested in turning Cuba into sort of Bahamas on steroids. It's a separate issue that's worrisome to Cubans, but there are a lot of people in the Chamber of Commerce universe who would like to keep this opening going.
Julian, last word to you on this policy. Where do you see it going, and how does it play out?
Well, look, at President-elect Trump is a hotel guy. He's a business guy. When he takes the White House, he will hear from a number of American companies that are now flying commercial planes starting this week to Cuba, building hotels on the island, American people, universities, museums across the board, Cuban Americans themselves investing in their families' businesses on the island, voting with their feet. Even Marco Rubio's constituents on the island taking advantage of the Obama opening. President-elect Trump has a choice to make. Does he want to go back to the Cold War and pick a fight and punish 11 million people for the trespasses of two guys named Castro? Or does he want to take the opportunity coming in 2018, when Raul Castro says he will step down, to really shape the direction of the two countries' relationship?
All right, we're going to have 10 seconds.
No, I would just not be surprised if 10 years from now there's a Trump golf course at the Bay of Pigs. Just mark my words.
All right. Thanks to both of you. We'll be back in 10 years to check on that. When we come back, we'll set aside politics for a moment and take a look at some people we're grateful for this Thanksgiving weekend.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Network's Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
As Americans celebrated Thanksgiving this week, we wanted to take a little break from politics to show our appreciation and present the work of those who devote their lives to helping others. We begin with a report from CBS News foreign correspondent Holly Williams, who spent Thanksgiving with U.S. troops in Erbil, Iraq.
They've spent months away from home, aiding in the fight against ISIS on the other side of the world.
Happy Thanksgiving. How are you?
Their Thanksgiving lunch wasn't shared with family, but with their brothers and sisters in the armed forces.
Got some stuff?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
The answer is always yes.
And when we asked some of the roughly 6,000 U.S. service members currently in Iraq what they're thankful for, many of them spoke of their loved ones. Major Rebecca DeMiro White and Captain Jeremy White were grateful just to be together for a few hours at Thanksgiving, meeting up at a military staging area around 10 miles east of Mosul. They've only been married 5 months.
So you're intentionally together here in Iraq. This was the only place you could be together.
Yeah, kind of.
It just works out that way.
At Camp Swift, where the U.S. military shares a command center with the Iraqi army, launching airstrikes against ISIS, Major Stephen Bryant serves as a chaplain, ministering to the spiritual needs of soldiers of all religions. But on his third tour of duty in Iraq, he's thankful for something rather practical, cell phones.
I think what's different this time is communications. So it's given me an opportunity to express that to my girls and to my wife and to my mom and dad and different family members more frequently. That I miss them, that I love them, and I certainly appreciate their support.
Others waxed poetic, like Private First Class One Beam from Fontana, Southern California.
I'm 19. I turned 20 in January. I'm turning 20 in Iraq. Yeah.
Private Beam told us he'd never been outside of California until he enlisted around a year ago. Now he's a perimeter guard at Camp Swift in a country that couldn't be any more foreign.
This is a humbling experience. Out here being humble, the experience to be able to like come and be humbled and see how other people live, vice to stuff that people think they need back in the States. The kids, they grow up, this is all they know, so no socks, no shoes, just running around playing soccer. It's crazy, but that's what I'm thankful for.
He's right, of course. No country will ever be perfect, and America will always have its problems. But in a world where there are 60 million people who have been forced from their homes, those of us who don't live in despair can count ourselves lucky. Specialist Monique Frink from Goldsboro, North Carolina, has the kind of relentless optimism that's infectious.
This lady.
One of a team of three cooks, she feeds 150 soldiers every day from this minuscule kitchen.
It's something I love, something I'm very passionate about. Food tells a story nothing else can. Like, you put your emotions in it. So I love it.
Our Holly Williams in Iraq. Vin Scully spent 67 years as the voice of the Los Angeles Dodgers.
It's time for Dodger baseball!
Before he retired this year. Last week, the president awarded him the Medal of Freedom, and we caught up with him outside the White House.
What's the trick to calling a game? Or if you had to teach me how to do it, what would you do?
I would quote Laurence Olivier, because I've lived by his quote. Apparently, some young actor asked him about his success, and he said, "My success comes from a humility to prepare and a confidence to bring it off. And I think the more you prepare, the more confidence you have, and they go hand in hand. That's the best of all.
You also have a sense of joy in what you do and wonder. How do you get that every time? You've watched so many games.
You know, I have a secret. When I was about 8 years old, we had a big old radio, four-legged radio, cross piece underneath. I would get a pillow, crawl under the radio. The loudspeaker would be right over my head. And I'd be listening to Tennessee, Alabama, which meant nothing to a little kid, you know, in New York. But what I loved was the roar of the crowd. And so when I do the game, 0-1 to Charlie, my philosophy is do it quickly, call the play accurately, and then shut up. And for a little while, when that crowd is roaring, I'm 8 years old.
When Hank Aaron hit that famous home run, you called that.
Yes, I was.
What, remember that for us. What was that like?
Well, it was building up, of course, all year long. And now here we are in Atlanta. And our left-hander, Henry Aaron, is batting against Al Downing. And, of course, you're wondering about the home run. But I didn't want to prepare anything. I didn't want to think of all the home runs he hit or how many against the Dodgers. And so when he hit the home run, I did what I really do best. I shut up. And I went back to the booth, and the crowd was roaring. It was magnificent. And while I stood there, it suddenly dawned on me. So when I went back to the microphone, I said,
"What a marvelous moment for baseball. What a marvelous moment for Atlanta and the state of Georgia. What a marvelous moment for the country and the world. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the Deep South for breaking a record of an all-time baseball idol."
And to me, of all the home runs, that's the most important one I ever saw.
And you hadn't thought about that connection
before? No, not at all.
You were quiet. You said nothing, I think, for a minute and 44 seconds.
I'm good at that. Really, really.
And that was you getting out of the way of the moment.
I did not want to get near it.
What speaks baseball to you more, the crack of the bat or the snap of the glove?
The roar of the crowd. I've been in love with that ever since I was a little boy.
What would you tell that little boy? He's under the radio. He's 8 years old. What would you tell him now with the award you've just received? What would you tell him?
I would tell him, don't be afraid to dream.
What are you grateful for?
I am grateful for God's grace to allow me to do what I've done for 67 years. I'm grateful for my wife, my 16 grandchildren, my 3 great-grandchildren, for a life that has been beyond fulfillment of a dream. Yes, I am deeply thankful.
You wrote in your farewell letter to fans, you said you would miss the fans. Some people might think, well, wouldn't you miss the game and the excitement? Why the fans?
Well, again, we get back to when they roar, I get goosebumps. And that's why I've kept young, I believe, because every time they roar, I go back to being 8 years old. I don't have a painting like Dorian Gray on the wall, but the crowd fulfills everything for me.
Is there any other moment from your career that when you look back, you say, the Hank Aaron home run would obviously be one. Is there another moment where you say, that, boy, that was a great moment?
I'll be very brief. I was in high school at the time, sitting in the back of the auditorium with the best athlete on campus. We were chatting. And he said, what would you like to do when you get out? And I said, I'd love to be a baseball announcer. He said, I'd love to be a baseball player. I said, wouldn't it be amazing if I became a baseball announcer and you became a major league player? It happened. 3 years into my career, he came up to bat. I was on the air, and he hit a home run. And I had to call my friend's home run in the big leagues. And that's why I would always say to kids, don't be afraid to dream, because it can happen.
And Scully, this was a great pleasure. Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
John, and the very same to you and yours.
Another thing we're thankful for, teachers. Johanna Hayes is a history teacher at John F. Kennedy High School in Waterbury, Connecticut, and was recognized this year as America's Teacher of the Year. We just heard Vin Scully talk about what brings him joy. What brings you joy?
That's easy. My students. I meet them at 14 when they're not really sure who they are and the impact that they can have. So helping them find their gift and using it to improve the human condition, to help others, I think that's what brings me joy.
And what's the secret to that? So many different kinds of students.
Relationships. Just showing kids that you care about them, showing them that you value them as people, and making them believe that they have the ability to do anything that they set their mind to and work hard at.
Excellent. All right. That's the beginning of our conversation, and we're going to be back on the other side of the break.
Okay.
And we'll talk a little bit more with Johanna Hayes. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
When you're opening a new office location, but deadlines don't let up, you need to make sure your team can start working fast, which means all of a sudden, you're looking to buy new conference tables, chairs, laptops, and whiteboards quickly. Business cards from American Express Open can give you buying power to help cover the big purchases you need to make when you need to make them. Find out how American Express cards and services can help prepare you for growth at open.com.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. We continue our conversations with people we are grateful for, including 2016 Teacher of the Year, Johanna Hayes. You were talking about students before. You said there is no benefit to anyone if a student achieves high grades, if they have no desire or knowledge of how to help others. What does that mean?
It means I think that the purpose of education is more than just graduating students who get good grades. I think that they need to be compelled to help out in their communities, to improve society, and that's really how I focus my teaching. I want my students to feel connected to their communities, to improve the places where they live, you know, to use what they've learned in school to help out. And I think that's what all teachers should do, you know, that students should know that it's a privilege to be able to give, and not everyone can do it. So I really bring my students out and try to get them involved in their community.
And what does that mean? How do you do that?
Oh, wow. We do all kinds of community service projects. We are actively involved in Habitat for Humanity, Relay for Life, the autism. We do homeless awareness, cancer awareness, food drives. I just want my students to know that they have the ability to improve the things in our country and in our world that they see as challenges. You know, no matter how young they are, they still can make an impact.
And if what does the student need to bring to you? What's the key quality that a student needs to learn?
Actually, I have so many students who come to me and they don't see anything in themselves. They don't realize that they have the capacity, you know, to achieve anything. And I try to help them discover that.
Why do they feel that way?
There's a lack of self-efficacy. You know, they've heard all the reasons why they can't do things. And I just try to remind them that you can do anything. You know, students, young people in general, kind of see the world from exactly where they are, the position that they're in today. They can't see, you know, the future. And I think that teachers have the ability to lead students. We see so much far beyond, you know, today or tomorrow. We look into the future and see the possibility that students bring.
Why should someone become a teacher?
Oh, because it's the best job ever. I think that I am uniquely positioned to impact the world, the future. You know, I have a front row seat to all the promise that we have. You know, I believe in what teachers do. You know, I know that the world would be better. Things would be better because I see students in front of me every day who have the ability to make those changes. So I consider myself very lucky.
All right. Well, Johanna Hayes, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Next, we turn to Brandon Stanton, the photographer and blogger behind Humans of New York. It started as a personal photography project 6 years ago. Since then, the presentation of simple but powerful personal reflections has grown into a social media phenomenon and two best-selling books. In our political season of division, his work was a constant reminder of our shared humanity. Brandon, I want to thank you for being here. You've interviewed thousands of people. When you took that first photograph, what did you set out to do?
Well, the process of discovering Humans of New York was very incremental. I lost my job. I was working in Chicago, and I just knew I wanted to be a photographer. I love taking photos, and I started kind of naturally falling into taking pictures of people. And then after that, I would start stopping people on the streets and taking their photo. And I'd only been photographing for about a month or two at that time, so I knew if I wanted to be a photographer, I probably didn't have a good chance of being the best photographer in the world. But I thought maybe I had a chance of being one of the best people in the world at stopping random strangers and taking their photographs. So that's how it began, and it grew from that into much more of a storytelling project where I actually interview these random people that I stop on the streets.
Why did you change to interviewing them? What?
I think it was just more interesting because I'd done it thousands of times, just stopped random people to take their photo. And I realized what was so interesting about my photography is that people are very curious about strangers around them. And I had developed this skill where I could walk up to any random stranger and enter into a conversation with them to take their photograph. And I knew if what made my work interesting was the aspect of interacting with a stranger, why not take that a step further and learn about this person?
And what have you learned over all of those interviews you've done?
You know, I like to, instead of trying to draw similarities between everybody, you know, I think my goal is to find something different about everybody. And, you know, one thing that I find is that we share so many philosophies, we share so many opinions, but the one thing that we have that is truly unique and makes us truly ourselves is our stories. And so when I interview somebody, my questions tend to follow the lines of trying to find out a story about this person that I have not heard from the other 10,000 people I've talked to.
And those stories, as I've looked in on Instagram and seen them, they are so powerful because they're so personal. One, recently, you were in Macomb County, and there was a couple, a husband and a wife. His wife has dementia. Tell us that story.
Right, and this is one that was kind of outside the box of what I normally do because I was in Macomb stopping random people on the street, and I had a fan of the website send me an email. And he said, you know, my father-in-law has been taking care of my mother-in-law who has severe dementia, and would you go visit them? And so I did, and I got there, and there was this man in this chair with his wife who he said he doesn't have her mentally, but he has her. And I sat down with them for about an hour and a half, learned the story of how they met, and they kind of fell in love, and then learned the story about how her Alzheimer's progressed. And spent some time, you know, talking to this man about the difficulties and, if you would ask him, the joys. He was a very joyful man, of watching his wife deteriorate and stepping into a relationship of caretaker where the relationship to husband and wife kind of subsided, but the relationship of caretaker to someone being cared for came up. And, you know, it was a very powerful conversation.
You went to Macomb County, photographed a lot of people, didn't mention their politics. Why did you do that?
Well, sometimes I did. I didn't look for it. I think that's the key point of the work is that, you know, I think what makes Humans of New York unique is the randomness of it. You know, I've traveled to Iran, I've traveled to Pakistan. These are countries that have very strong narratives told about them in the media, whether they're related to the nuclear deal or whether they're related to terrorism. And so what you have is you have people being asked about their thoughts and their opinions on things such like as that. And what I do, and the same thing I did in Macomb County, is I just stop people randomly and I ask what their greatest struggles are. And you find that even in Macomb County was a very important swing county. You know, it's being talked about a lot. And every time it's being talked about in relation to the election. What's your opinion of Trump? You know, why did you vote for Hillary? And we're framing these people based on their political affiliations. But if you actually stop these people and say, what is your greatest struggle right now? It's about their wife's dementia, their son's alcoholism. And you find that they don't identify themselves in the way that we're identifying them. They see themselves as fathers or husbands. And I think Humans of New York, by stopping people randomly and giving them a chance to express their stories, shows more of the identities that people see themselves as.
All right, Brandon Stanton, thanks so much for your work and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Earlier this month, the Surgeon General issued a report saying that 1 in 7 Americans is expected to develop a substance use disorder at some point in their lives. John Schinholzer and Honest Lee Liller of the McShin Foundation in Virginia are on the front lines of this epidemic. Honest Lee, I want to start with you. What does it look like in terms of the uptick in with opioid abuse and that you see?
Right. Well, at McShin, about 80% of our participants in our program are recovering from opioid addiction. It's all around the country. It's a huge spike in lots of opiates, you know, prescription pain meds along with the heroin. The heroin is cheaper after you're done with the prescription pain meds. So it's more and more people getting addicted, and to be honest with you, at a very younger age than on average. And that's all around the nation, not just in Richmond.
Tell me about your personal story.
Well, I'm a person in long-term recovery from my SUD. I've been drug and alcohol-free for over 9.5 years. I started using when I was 12 years old. I stopped when I was 26. The last 9 years of my active addiction was opioids and heroin. And I came to the McShin Foundation when I was 26 years old with nothing. Same-day service, John and Carol, his wife, the Mick and McShin, took me in. I had nothing. I had a couple bags of clothes. I didn't have custody of my daughter, and I was practically living out of my Jeep. Now, today, my life is amazing. 9.5 years later, because of recovery and John and Carol taking a chance on me, I own a home. I'm a taxpayer. I can vote. I'm a mommy. I'm a wife. And I'm the CEO of McShin. So I get to be surrounded by people that I love, and I get to be able to see people change and their lives change because of recovery, that peer-to-peer, been there, done that. This is what life was. This is what life is today. So be able to help these people and save their lives and heal their families.
John, what is the most important thing a person needs who needs help?
Well, I think the most important thing is that if you have an addiction, there is help out there, that anybody can stop using drugs, find a new way to live and lose that desire. All you got to do is ask for it, and hopefully you'll find the right doorway to go through, and they'll be smart enough to give you the help the same day you ask for it. Hopefully that's what it will look like.
But a lot of people have trouble asking for help. A lot of people
God, it's the hardest thing in the world is for an individual to come to grips with an addiction and say, look, I need help. What do I do? And a lot of times they reach out for help just to get their hand slapped. So we have to stop that as a nation. We got to start helping people. The day they ask for help, we got to give it to them instead of turning them back out in our community.
What do you mean by getting their hand slapped?
Well, a lot of times somebody will come in and ask for help from like a service provider, and they'll say they'll come back in a week or two or three, and the next thing you know, you go back out into Target or Walmart, and then you're a public safety threat at that point, and then the sheriff gets you. So we've got to stop streeting people and help them the day they ask for it, to include emergency rooms in America. All across America, people are growing up in these emergency rooms, a place where they're supposed to get help for a medical condition, just to be told to get out of here. So we've got to stop that as a country. We know better. We've got to do better.
Honesty, the most important thing you mentioned was that, you know, when you're talking to somebody, you can say, I was there mm-hmm. with you. What about as a larger culture? What can the rest of us do?
Just be a voice. It's not just those that are addicted to drugs and alcohol. It's the family members and the people in the community that have been affected. You know, anyone can be able to help someone, you know, that has a struggling issue. I think it's really important to continually to talk about it. And if you have a voice in your local community with a policymaker, like, give them our number. Like, we're really good at what we do in the advocacy piece, because it's not just, okay, help that individual. Like, how do we help them? It's healing a whole entire community, and that's the nation at large. So anyone can be a voice for anything. It's just important to be educated on, you know, what you're talking about and been there, done that lived experience. We have, it's not just us in recovery, but the family members that have been affected by this disease that are speaking up and going to the General Assembly and doing what they have to do as well to fight for those that, A, don't even know about recovery, and those that are, you know, changing their lives.
All right. Honesty and John, we really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you very much. This is amazing. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks for what you do. Okay. And now back to politics and our political panel. Joining us today is Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Ed O'Keefe of The Washington Post. His colleague, Ruth Marcus, is a columnist and deputy editorial page editor at The Post. And Ramesh Punuru is a senior editor at The National Review. Ramesh, I want to start with you. Donald Trump has made some staff picks. He's thinking about some others. Do you have a unified theory of what he's doing? Is there a clear message to the picks he's made?
I don't have a unified theory, and I'm not sure he has a unified theory either. But I would say that the transition is going much better than one might have expected a couple of weeks ago, when there was all this breathless coverage about what a disaster it was turning out to be. The interesting thing going on in the transition right now is this very public fight going on about who is going to be the Secretary of State in a Trump administration, where you have top Trump advisors like Kellyanne Conway really blasting the idea that Mitt Romney might be that person.
I'm going to hold off on the Secretary of State drama because it is fascinating to watch in public. But, Ruth, I just wanted to get on some of the names that have already been made. I was interested that on the one hand you had Donald Trump in his interview with the New York Times say Kelly Ayotte, former senator from New Hampshire, was never going to get anything because she had said that Donald Trump was not a role model for her children. Then Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, who had been very critical of Donald Trump, is now the ambassador to the U.N. So what do you make of those two different decisions?
Sometimes he can be more magnanimous than others. I do have to say to Ramesh, if this transition is going well, I would really like to see one that's going poorly. Because let's be clear, and I'm going to just channel Tolstoy here, all transitions are chaotic, but they're each chaotic in their own unique way. This one is crazy. Well, first of all, we're having a transition by Twitter, right? He's communicating with us. Normal presidents-elect have press conferences. This one has a Twitter account with peevish tweets. He's picking people in the most haphazard way. Usually you submit your national security team and then your domestic policy team. It's just kind of random people. You pick your UN ambassador before you pick your Secretary of State. And finally, this remarkable, I know we're not getting to it yet, this remarkable public dissent we can't stop talking about.
Well, Molly, do you sign up for that? Because Senator Jeff Sessions, that was an obvious pick. Mike Flynn for the National Security Advisor. These are loyalists who are in the Trump camp. That seems like a...
So I do have a grand unified theory, which is that Donald Trump is running the transition exactly the way he ran his campaign, which was exactly the way he's always run his business. He creates competing power centers and pits them against one another. He likes to have underlings squabbling for his favor. It's always very clear that he is the one in charge, and he bestows his favor sort of arbitrarily and capriciously and haphazardly. So everyone is always kept on their toes. Nobody ever knows quite where they stand with him. This is his style, personnel-wise, and always has been. Now, there is no ideological consistency, right? Someone like a Jeff Sessions, you know, someone like a Steve Bannon, who is not a traditional Republican, paired with someone like a Reince Priebus, who is, someone like a Jeff Sessions, who's been at odds with many other Republicans in the Senate, paired with someone like a Nikki Haley, who is much more of a traditional conservative. And I don't think we should expect there to be any ideological consistency, because Trump himself has very little ideological consistency. He's much more interested in personality, and the way he seems to be making these choices, the vetting process seems to be, you know, come to my tower and I shall evaluate you. And he's making choices on that basis.
Ed, what Molly describes is actually what some people described FDR's management, battles and fights, yeah. And then see how it goes. So there is a tradition of this. What do you make of it, Ed? And now finally we can talk to the Secretary of State point, which is this public debate going on between whether he's going to pick Rudy Giuliani or Mitt Romney or maybe Bob Corker, senator from Tennessee, or maybe a player to be named later.
Yeah, I mean, look, everyone who's exasperated by all this needs to get over it. This is the way it's going to be. This is the way he is. And I just think, you know, this is the new normal, in essence, for presidential management. The idea that it has to be done a certain way, I think, is foolhardy, because he hasn't done anything the normal way, and he won. And so... don't be surprised by any of this, is sort of what I've been telling aggrieved relatives and exasperated colleagues and everyone else. As for Secretary of State, look, my only question is, how can a Republican-controlled Senate confirm someone like Rudy Giuliani, given his business practices over the last few years, when you've spent the last several years prosecuting Hillary Clinton for doing similar things? He's been a consultant to... world leaders, some of questionable degree. He's been giving speeches all over the world. He can argue that, you know, that gives him vast experience, which is the same argument in some respects that the Clintons were making, that they had these connections around the world. But, you know, I don't see how certain Republican lawmakers can have spent the last few years doing what they did and saying what they said about her and then turn around and confirm him when he was doing much the same.
But the thing we need to talk about is the remarkable spectacle of his own campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, publicly differing with him on Twitter and in public interviews about the wisdom of Romney as Secretary of State. Anybody has any precedent for this, I'd like to hear it.
So I'll read you. Kellyanne Conway tweeted, receiving deluge of social media and private comms communications, Ray Romney, some Trump loyalists warn against Romney as Secretary of State. And so, Ramesh, some people see that as the former campaign manager arguing with her boss through Twitter, not, you know, in the boardroom.
She says that she's given the same advice privately. And it's certainly true that this has not been done before, but I assume that she's doing it knowing that Trump doesn't mind her doing it, that he may even like this kind of drama. And so she figures, why not? I think some of the points she's making are actually reasonable ones. It is perfectly reasonable for an incoming president to want cabinet members who are loyal to him, who will not make a big resignation in principle that hurts the administration. And given their history together, one has to worry about that if you're Donald Trump, about Mitt Romney.
It's also interesting that Kellyanne Conway is positioning herself as speaking for the grassroots, speaking for Donald Trump's supporters, saying this is, and you know, I think there may be a personal side to it for her as well, but it is true that, you know, she is his connection in a way to the millions of people out there in America who are not part of any other political party or movement, but who are loyal to Trump. And if she is indeed sounding a signal that he doesn't want to turn against those people, you know, there would not be another voice in his ear or in his administration that would be speaking for those people, and presumably that's important to him.
Ed, I want to get to this question of Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. He's got businesses all over the world. As you mentioned, a lot of this campaign was about the conflicts between the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Secretary of State. Where are we on the question of Donald Trump's private interests and Donald Trump's presidency?
Well, he so far embraces the fact that he is a global businessman and has made no publicly apparent moves to really divest himself of it all. It's a complicated thing. But I think what we need to remember is that current federal law would allow him to continue doing this. And I think the question is, will the country want somebody who is potentially a part-time president, who is also a part-time CEO of some degree? And if not, how will the public react? I think, you know, if there's evidence that he or his family is ingratiating themselves of the presidency while other things aren't getting fixed as he promised, then we'll see a reaction. But this is uncharted waters, and we'll have to see.
Ruthie told the New York Times, essentially, presidents can't have conflicts of interest.
Well, let me tell you this. They can, and he does. The federal law does not cover this, but there's obviously the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, and there is the way presidents have behaved in the past. This is a very dangerous road he's going down. It's totally obvious that somebody with his massive holdings is going to have a problem. He should have planned for this. He was remarkably unprepared for this, and he's been remarkably obtuse since being elected about the need, even if you're not going to divest your holdings, to separate his business life from his presidential life. Instead of separating, he's piling conflict on conflict, inviting his children into both the government and the business.
Ramesh, what do you think other Republicans should other Republicans care about this? Is it going to get in the way of business congressional Republicans want to get done, do you think?
Well, there's no statutory problem that he's got right now. I don't think he's got a political problem in the sense of his supporters in the polls turning against him. But I do think he's creating trouble for himself and his administration and for Republicans down the line, because there's the potential for any number of scandals. There's the potential that otherwise reasonable decisions get second-guessed because people wonder, is there some private interest of the Trump company that is biasing our decisions? I think they'd be better off taking steps to prevent those sorts of conflicts.
Molly, 15 seconds. Any immediate steps they could take?
Well, he could get rid of his business, but he doesn't want to do that. You know, this whole campaign for Donald Trump was about shattering norms, refusing to accept, for example, the tradition of candidates releasing their tax returns. He feels that he got away with it. He feels that he was vindicated. I think he therefore feels that he doesn't have to do the traditional things that presidents have done. We shall see if he gets away with it when this becomes about basically massive state corruption.
All right, we'll end on that. Thanks, all of you, for the brisk panel. That's it for us today. For Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. Today's guest was Senator Marco Rubio. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday.